Hi, this is Randall Schwartz, host of Floss Weekly. This week, Gareth Greenaway and Guillermo Amaral join me. We're going to turn the tables. They're going to be asking me the questions. You're not going to want to miss this, so stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, Gareth Greenaway, and Guillermo Amaral. Episode 310, recorded October 1st, 2014. Ask Randall Anything. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show about free, libre, open-source software. I am your host, Randall Schwartz, Merlin at StoneEdge.com, bringing you each week, or as often as I can, the movers, the shakers, the big projects, the little projects, the projects you might not be heard of, projects you might be using every day and not aware of it. This week is sort of an exception because I have a slightly different topic this week. This week, the topic is me. This show is called Ask Randall Anything. We wanted to give a chance for you guys to give me feedback about things you might want to know about, maybe what happens behind the scenes of the show, maybe what happens the rest of my life, and so on. So I am not only the host this week, but I'm also the guest. But joining me this week, I have not one, because it couldn't be filled, but just one, to two co-hosts, count them two. Let's go ahead and bring on Gareth Greenaway. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Randall. Thanks for having me back.
Cool. And where are you speaking to us from?
I am speaking from my underground lair in Thousand Oaks, California.
Absolutely. And this time, actually, I've been a ways away from me. And for those that aren't watching the video stream, you might not notice that behind me is, in fact, my closet door of my apartment in Beaverton, Oregon, beautiful downtown Beaverton. So I am at home for a change. And also our other co-host this week, Gareth already did. How about Guillermo Amaral? Welcome back to the show.
Hey, man, how's it going? I'm not Gareth, by the way. No.
Yeah, I know. Guillermo. I said Guillermo. I changed it.
I know. Just, you know, everybody got, trying to make that sure. I've got the hair.
He's definitely.
He gets a flat top type style. I got the stylish hair. That's where you can tell us apart.
Yeah, and where are you speaking to us from?
From Tijuana, Mexico, man. My home lab here. It's, above ground. This isn't underground now.
Yeah, cool. I may be seeing you this weekend. I'm actually going to be down in Tijuana with my friend Ed Tuttle, who is going to be hauling me around. I get to stay in his apartment when I'm down there, so it makes it a little bit easier for me. And I'll get to do the usual stuff there. I'll just leave it at that. So we'll leave that really vague and open. Okay, so I've already said at the top of the show that this is Ask Randall Anything. So I am going to sort of shut up for now and let you two kind of duke it out about who's asking me what questions and where. If you're on the live chat at live.twit.tv, we'll be taking questions from there as well. We have a few questions actually already emailed in over the past week, but I am just going to act amazingly surprised at whatever you guys ask me. So without further ado, let's go ahead and start the show.
Okay. Well, we have a question from Jungle Boogie, and okay. He asks, "What's an interesting problem you have ever solved with Perl?"
Oh man, I've solved so many things with Perl. I think the most interesting things I've ever solved with Perl involve text transformation. So looking at text and turning it into some other sort of operations of some kind. I've used Perl Descent, one of my favorite modules for that. I'm now looking at a new module called, written by a friend of mine, Jeffrey Kegler, maintained actually by somebody else now, but that does amazing parsing stuff. I'm actually looking for a problem to solve with that. I think one of the other problems I've solved with Perl is making a living for 30 years. So I think that's probably the best problem I have solved with Perl is making a living. So we'll start with that.
So a follow-up question to that, what interesting problems have you not been able to solve with Perl?
Ooh, that would be tougher. That would be tougher, and the answer, while I'm talking out loud, while I'm thinking of the answer, darn little, I think, is probably going to have to be the answer to that. I've been so flexible with Perl. Perl's so flexible to use that I've been able to apply it almost everywhere, and I'm trying to think of where I haven't been able to do it. Oh, probably something on my phone, because there's not a Perl interpreter on my phone, so I have to kind of rely on what other third parties and fourth parties actually deliver for my phone. So that's probably the answer to that.
So what got you interested in Perl?
Oh, yeah, that's back in the early days. So I was a big Unix user from 1977 onwards, and I was really, really good at doing stuff with sed and awk and grep and all the other the shell Unix tools based like that. And then I had been using this little thing called RN that Larry Wall had created to read my news. And he announced one day that he was going to come up with a tool that that would be sort of an awk or sed replacement called Perl. And when Perl 1.0 came down the line, I downloaded it. This is back when Usenet days, when you downloaded about 60 individual files and glued them all together. It was called a shell archive. And I started playing with Perl 1, and it was a upward semantically compatible replacement for sed and awk, but it wasn't very interesting yet. But when Perl 2 came out, I said, hey, this is something that I could really get into. So I started rewriting all of my complex sed and awk and shell scripts with Perl 2 and started talking about it on the net. And by talking about, this is back in the Usenet days, I started talking about it so much on the net that I became sort of associated with the guy who talks a lot about Perl. And when Perl 3 came out, an opportunity came along for me to write the book about it. And the rest, of course, is 20 years of history after that.
So what would you say, from what you've seen over the history of Perl, since you've been using it since Perl 2, what is the most interesting development been since you started using it?
I think the shift from Perl 4 to Perl 5 that basically opened up the opportunity to write very large programs in Perl and scale well, and also write object-oriented programs and deal with complex data structures. I think that was the biggest shift, and that was, I think, what, 18 years ago. Perl 6 is interesting, but Perl 6 is not the successor to Perl 5. Perl 6 is a separate language that has a lot of the things that we like that made Perl 5 interesting, but I think Perl 5 is going to be around for quite a long time. They're already talking about 5.22 and 5.24. They're just going to keep making new releases of Perl 5, so I'll have plenty to do throughout the rest of my career, however long I want that to be, probably at least another 5 or 10 years.
So we have another question from the chat.
Cool.
How did you get started as a programmer?
Oh, wow. Well, that goes out back even further. So my dad, rest his soul, was very career oriented, very much like, son, someday you're going to have to, you know, go out in the real world and make a living somehow and pay your bills. And unfortunately, he only told me to pay bills. He didn't actually tell me to get rich. Otherwise, I'd be rich now. But I have always paid my bills. And so I knew pretty early on that I had to pick some sort of career path. This is back in the early days when I was like 9 and 10 maybe. This is back when Popular Electronics was very popular. The new 7400s had just come out, the new little, you know, hex inverter on a single inline chip, 14-pin and 16-pin chips. And so we had a lab that Dad and I built the whatever was on the front cover of Pop Electronics. We would build those as kits and stuff, and Heath kits. We would assemble those together. I also was liking math at the time. I was sort of intermediate math and advanced math, also coming up. So I started to think about it. I went, wait, I like math. I like electronics. Maybe I'd like computers. And so I suggested that to my dad one day, and one of the things he did was heating, air conditioning, appliance repair, and so on and stuff. And so he was working for a client who happened to have an electronics store. We would get a lot of our stuff at discounts from there. And so he brought home one day a bunch of PDP-8 manuals. This is back in the early days when DEC's sort of flagship model for their scientific computing was the PDP-8. 12-bit memory with actual memory cores. You could actually see a bit back in the early days when you could see an actual bit. But one of the manuals was on a high-level language called Focal, F-O-C-A-L. I started pawing through that, and I wrote out on a piece of, lined paper, I wrote a program that I had sort of derived from looking at the examples in this Focal manual. And I ran down to the lab and took that to the dad, and I said, this is what I want to do. I want to write programs for a living. And he said, really? And so about a month later, I come home from school, And my dad usually worked late hours because he was self-employed and, you know, he had clients and stuff that had odd hours as well. So I came home and mom pointed this book at me on the shelf and said, can you, dad wants you to read through this manual and see if this is something that you could also write languages in or write programs in. And so it was a program, HP 2100 Timeshared Basic. Back in the early days. And I was pawing through it. I said, yeah, that's pretty simple and stuff. So dad came home and said, why don't you say, you know, if you like what's in this book, save next Saturday so for me to bring you along. And I said, okay, so I saved next Saturday. And it turns out that he had arranged with the high school, even though I was only in grade school at the time, he'd arranged with the high school for the computer teacher to give me access to a ASR33 teletype that had a dial in 110 baud uppercase only to the shared computer system the school districts had. And before that, I had written out a program that type 1 to add, type 2 to subtract, 3 to multiply, 4 to divide, a nice little simple basic program about 110 lines long or so. And more like 50 lines, actually, because it was all on one sheet of paper. And so when he got there Saturday, I was proudly carrying my HP 2100 Timeshare Basic book and this piece of paper that I'd written. And the computer teacher said, well, let's start at the beginning of the book. And I said, can I just type this in and see if it works? And he was like amazed. He said, wait, you already have read through this book and you've already written a program. And that was it. That was my first program. And I typed it in and it worked perfectly. I typed a 1 and typed 2 numbers in and it added them together, printed out the sum, typed a 3 and it multiplied the 2 numbers together and so on. And so my very first program had no bugs. Haven't been so happy since then, but first program. And that's when I knew that this is what I wanted to do. I wanted to be a programmer. So that was when I was, I think, 9. So it'd be 1970. And I thought at that point that programming would involve either banks or government. Little did I know that just a couple years later, the microcomputer revolution came along and Pop Electronics featured the Altair 880 computer on its front cover. Never made one of those, but I did build an MSI 8080 for my school. So that was my exposure to actual hardware for a change. And I've been a programmer ever since. And then a lot of other things as well. A writer, teacher, podcaster, obviously, and so on.
So I don't think it's any secret to anyone that regularly watches the show, but you are a big fan of the Emacs editor.
Yeah.
What is it about Emacs that you like?
Well, I like it because, now mind you, I picked Emacs before Vim existed. So I was a big VI user for many years, but Vim had not come out yet. So, but one of the things that was interesting is that, as I mentioned earlier, we're using RN, the newsreader, and the system administrators decided that too many people were reading news during the daytime. It was slowing the systems down. This was a PDP 1170 running Unix version 7, I believe it was, or maybe it was one of the early BSDs. And they decided that too many people were reading news, so they forced the RN program to be automatically niced, which meant that it had lower priority, which meant it ran way too slow. But I discovered that there was a news reader built into GNU Emacs called GNUs, G-N-E-W-S. This is before GNUs, G-N-U-S, which unfortunately is pronounced the same way, but G-N-E-W-S is long abandoned development, but G-N-U-S I've actually had some contribution for. And so I knew that if I was inside the text editor, Emacs, reading Usenet, nobody could tell because you can't tell what it's actually doing. So I used that to get around the system administrators wanting to slow down everybody reading news. I was reading news inside my text editor. You couldn't slow down the text editor. And I started learning a lot about Emacs Lisp, and I've actually contributed to the Emacs text editor, the Pretty Printer, that takes an arbitrary Emacs Lisp S expression and then indents it properly and puts new lines in the proper places. That's mine. So if you look at in every copy of Emacs, there's Randall Schwartz code there. So I'm kind of affiliated with it. I kind of like it that I've been able to contribute to that. When I posted my code for the Pretty Printer, by the way, pp.el, Richard Stallman actually called it brilliant and wanted to immediately have assignment rights so he could actually put it in the core distribution. So I thought it was pretty cool to have been able to contribute to that. I've also contributed to GNUs, so my name's in the credits for that. Did some stuff about binary downloads and things like that because I wanted to be able to do all that stuff. So Yeah, so I like Emacs because it's programmable. It does what I want it to do. I can keep extending it with more features, although these days I mostly just configure it. I don't actually do a lot of writing my own Emacs Lisp code anymore. I tend to do most of my cool text manipulation in Perl instead. Long answer to a short question.
So one of the questions from the chat room, just kind of a follow-up to that, was why has Richard Stallman never appeared on the TWiT network?
Well, I know why he hasn't appeared on this show, because I refuse to say GNU Linux. I believe it is called Linux. And he and I have actually been at conferences together, and I will sometimes, it's like sitting at a table with him, we'll mention the word Linux. And he goes, "You mean just the kernel, right? Not the whole operating system." Now listen, I've partied with Richard Stallman, and I've partied with Linus Torvalds. Linus is a much better partier. And Linus wants to call it the whole thing just Linux. So I believe Linus. He'll never say that out loud, by the way, but he was on a cruise with me once, and I mentioned something like, "So what do you think about this whole GNU Linux thing?" And he grabbed me in a headlock and said, "You know, Randall, I was starting to like you." So this is how I know. This is how I know right from the horse's mouth, not calling Linus any kind of horse, but right from the horse's mouth, it's Linux. It's not GNU Linux. Stallman is mad because he didn't get his herd out quick enough, and so he's trying to dovetail off of the coattails of the Linux movement, and he doesn't get that right. And that's why he doesn't that's why he's not on my show, because I refuse to kowtow to his requirement to call it GNU Linux. And I bet that's also true for a lot of other shows. Are there actually, what other shows would he be on the TWiT network, really? Maybe Security Now or something, but yeah, I don't know. There, so there's the long answer.
So is there any reason you haven't tried BIM, or have you tried BIM recently after giving Emacs all your time?
Well, let's see. That's a good question. No, my fingers are. I mean, a few times I have to invoke VI, and I guess it ends up being Vim. Because I'm on a system that Emacs isn't installed on, or I don't want to wait the 22 seconds for Emacs to fire up. By the way, I boot Emacs about once a month on my main server, and I have run it inside a tmux session, so it's there all the time. So every once in a while I have to reboot Emacs to bring things back on. I remember the VI keys, but I don't remember them very well, and I don't want to learn the whole rest of the programming. I know that there's a embedded Perl as one of the options for Vim. I thought that'd be kind of interesting, but there was also embedded Perl for Emacs, but I never got into that either. So I'm happy with Emacs Lisp. It's a nice language, but no, I have not seriously given it a try. It's true. I have not tried Python either, so there we go. It's just things I won't do. I don't have time to learn new things like that.
Yeah, I remember trying Emacs for a little while, and in fact, I started using Emacs for GNUs because I used Usenet a lot, and I mm-hmm. could get my email in there too. So it was kind of like having your email and your news Usenet intermixed. It was really awesome for a little while, but I couldn't get past the startup, as you mentioned. It's just so long, and then you have to build it if you want to use it on a different server or something. It's just painful. Yep. So I went back with BIM. But we do have another question from the chat. So why is Linux successful where GNU wasn't, at least in your point of view?
You mean herd? You mean their OS? Yeah. I think Linux was successful because it was the right time, right thing, the right time, right place. And it was complete. It actually worked. And it was out about, 6 or 7 years before, because the herd's not even done yet. Right? Is it bootable? Can we run it on systems yet? I think it's just, right time, right place. Linus did an amazing job at getting it popularized and shared by a lot of people, and a lot of people contributing to him on it. That was the mark of a leader. As much as Stallman has done in terms of sort of keeping the faith for the Free Software Foundation, I'm not sure that he's sort of a coordinating leader in the same sense that Linus is. So I think it's probably why Linux has been a lot more successful.
So one of the other questions that was sent to us by Jungle Boogie was, what's your favorite software license and your least favorite software license?
Well, I like different licenses for different reasons. So that's my first initial cop-out. I tend to like permissive licenses, like the Apache, the BSDs, the original MIT license for X11 and the other things related to that, because they essentially make everyone equal. I, as the author, have a number of rights available to me. If I use a BSD-style license and I give the software to you, you have pretty much all the same rights that I do, including the right to keep it, to make the next generation of it proprietary, just like I do. The GPL and the restrictive licenses along that realm make a distinction between the first author and all the remaining authors, such that I have a number of rights as the original author, but I retain some of those rights before I distribute it to you. Now, you and all the subsequent users slash authors slash contributors all have pretty much equal rights. But the first original author is distinguished with GPL-style licenses. And that sort of leaves out that notion that everybody's equal. I like the BSD-style licenses because they make everyone equal. Everyone can do whatever they want, which is really nice. It sort of is more permission than restriction, which is nice that way. From a practical perspective, I've worked for hundreds of clients over the years, and I know, maybe not rightfully so, but I know a lot of them have a sort of GPL phobia, that if things are brought in with GPL, somehow it'll taint whatever they're doing, because if it's in the same distribution, then it'll have to be distributed under the same GPL. And so I know there are places, again, right or wrong, I'm not going to claim one way or the other, that the GPL is not allowed. Things that are GPL are not allowed. Perl is sort of weird, and that's released under both the – it was released under the original GPL plus the artistic license. Now I think it's just under artistic too for Perl. But the artistic license is very close to the BSD-style licenses. So having grown up with Perl and grown up to the – and seen all the places Perl could be used and be adapted and adopted and everything, I'm really happy that Perl adopted such a open license, such a free license. So just in terms of things I like, licenses I like the freer licenses more than I like the restrictive licenses. And that's probably the long answer to that, which is good because we need good long answers because we still have quite a bit of show left. So next question.
Okay, so this is a compound question. Basically, first, do you like, are you actually using Linux? And if so, what's your distro?
So no, and therefore the second question is moot, or as who was it, Chandler would say, not Chandler, it was not Chandler, who's the other guy that was on the silly guy, the actor guy on Friends, it wasn't Chandler, Joey. That was
Joey.
Who, what? Joey, Joey. Yeah, as Joey, yeah, Joey. As Joey would say, the point is moo. if you haven't seen that, Google for "the point is moo." It's a great YouTube clip of that particular show. But it's a great, you know, like a cow moo. It doesn't make any difference. So yeah. Anyway, so back to the first question, because the first question is actually a useful question for me. I don't particularly care for Linux. I grew up with real Unix, and there's enough different about Linux with the GNU versions of all the popular tools that were sort of invented and made up that my hands don't move the right way. So I'm much happier with OS X, which is a BSD-derived, I think actually FreeBSD user space for my desktop. So I'm using OS X. Even though it's proprietary, I still get to do a lot of open source software with it, like I just compiled Emacs this morning, as I typically do every day. And I use FreeBSD on my servers for both me and my primary client, InsightCruises.com, because FreeBSD is great. It has a huge port system. It has a real big dev team behind it, so we get good security patches immediately, things like that. It runs the PF firewall, which I find to be interesting. I learned about that from OpenBSD World, and now when I went to FreeBSD, it's the same exact firewall. Actually, it's a little out of sync now, but they're working on that. And it also has ZFS for booting, so I can boot on a really nice OS and boot on a really nice file system. I love ZFS. Every system I can possibly put it on, I will have ZFS. So yeah, I use FreeBSD in the cloud, and I use OS X on my desktop. And yes, I have an iPhone sitting over there getting charged somewhere, and it's running some proprietary iOS. I used to jailbreak it, but don't need to do that anymore because the non-jailbroken versions are now very close. So I'm kind of liking that. So no Linux.
So a question from the chat room from Web6779. Are there any proprietary programs?
Some anonymous person, yes.
Are there any proprietary programs that you wish you could replace with a free and open source alternative that does not exist?
I'm going to make some people angry, but hey, it's my show. I want a real open source version of Photoshop. I hate that I have to pay for Photoshop to get what Photoshop does. And if you tell me the GIMP is close, it's not. It's not really close. Somebody who says the GIMP is close needs to sit down with Photoshop for a while and see just how different it is. Okay. The GIMP is a nice attempt at being somewhat Photoshop-like, but it is not even close. I want Photoshop. I want a real Photoshop. I also want a real good video editing system with a nice linear editing, things like that. We've actually interviewed a couple people on this show, I think OpenShot Live or something like that, and I tried those for a while. No. You guys, you're building open source software. Go try these proprietary pieces and see what they do. If they're not what you guys are writing. So I'm a little miffed at that. So there we go. My people in the chat room, I'm not supposed to look at the chat room, but people saying Blender's good too. Yeah, I know. I've actually pulled that out to do some video editing at one point. But it's too much stuff to learn. Actually, how I edit, I do video editing with there's a proprietary program. It's some sort of desktop recorder. I can't remember the name of it. But it started out just being, you know, record your entire desktop and put it in a file so that you can have it later. And then they added like a nice editing system that actually is really good to use. And so I just drag video into there. Even though I'm not recording my desktop anymore, I just drag video into there and edit it with that. So I forget the name of it right now, but I'm sure somebody's going to be responding in the chat room. But it's a really nice thing. It's proprietary. It's like a couple $100, but it does the job. Not Cam Studio, no. Something else. What's it called? Some sort of desktop recorder or ScreenFlow. ScreenFlow, that's it. ScreenFlow. I highly recommend that as a proprietary video editing system for OS X. And guess what? The mowers have just started outside. It must be mowing time again. Well, hopefully you guys can't hear this too well. Anyway, go ahead. Ask me another question.
Okay, there's another one. Somebody's asking if they should try PCBSD. What's your thoughts?
PCBSD, I've played with it a little bit. It's basically just the desktop version of FreeBSD. If I had a desktop, I'd probably be running PCBSD on it. Well, I've had a desktop that wasn't running OS X, so... but since there's no advantage to use that on the server side, so I wouldn't need it for that. So, but yeah, if you want a good desktop, PCBSD is great. It's a great way to get into FreeBSD because the installer is really nice. Now, I've heard they've added in FreeBSD 10, which I haven't had a chance to play with much yet, some of the installer features that PCBSD once had. So maybe that there's less divergence coming through. I don't know. Okay. Anyway. So, yes, try it. Try PCBSD. Go ahead.
So a completely different question, but
cool.
Interesting nonetheless. If you were not doing everything that you do now, like if you weren't doing your work with Perl, if you weren't hosting Floss Weekly, if you weren't teaching, writing, what would you be doing as a profession?
Stand-up comedy. Stand up. Yes, exactly. Or writing comedy books or something like that. I don't know. I do enough of that sort of in my classes and stuff anyway. I've actually been paid for a half hour comedy presentation once at a conference. I got it was really funny. I was I used to go to the local comedy club here in Portland. There's only one. I used to go there like weekly with a bunch of my friends. And that's a whole other story. If we've got time, I can tell that story eventually, too. But so I used to go every week, and I'd love it because we were so much regulars that they'd give us the same big table right near the stage. And I was right there, you know, watching three or four comedians every week, usually a couple local opening acts and then maybe a headliner that's on tour somewhere. And I really loved that kind of live comedy and stuff. So one day we were going around the table introducing ourselves ahead of time, and everybody would bring their friends and stuff. And the girl that was sitting across from me turned to me and said, "What do you do?" And I said, "Well, I'm a professional comedian." And in my mind, what I meant by saying that was that, yes, I teach classes, and I like to work a little bit of comedy into my classes. So, yes, I get paid for basically tell jokes, but it's what I'm really paid for is teach people Perl. And then in the middle of that, I'm telling jokes. Well, she said, "Oh, I really?" And I said, "Yeah, technology jokes." I said, "Yeah, yeah." And so she said, "I need your card then, because I have a need for someone just like you." And that was amazingly surprising. But I gave her my card. My card's real generic. Just says, Randall Schwartz, General Manager, Stunnings Consulting Services. Doesn't explain what I do or anything like that. And that's deliberately anonymous that way. Because I never know what situation I'm going to be in, what I might do. So she calls me the next week or emails me the next week and says, I work at Mentor Graphics, which was at one point the big local high-tech firm here, second only to Tektronix in terms of employment and stuff like that. And she says, we're having our annual conference coming up in about 2 months, and we need some entertainment for one of our lunch programs. And if you're doing technical comedy, then obviously that's exactly who I want there. So I said, sure. Sure, I can do that. And so I put her in touch with my my assistant at the time, Janina. And so she starts emailing Janina about details. And Janina says to me, she says, oh, now she's asking how much I'm going to charge for this half hour of comedy that I'm going to do there. And I said, Janina, you know what the answer to that is always. And she goes, yeah, yeah, okay. So she writes back, and she writes back to this contact. She says, Randall wants to know, what's your budget? Because that's always my answer to how much does something cost? What's your budget? Okay, so she wrote back and she said, do you think he'll do it for as little as 10 grand? So Janine and I are laughing over this email. I said, yeah, I think I'll do a half hour comedy for 10 grand. Now, keep in mind, of course, that a half hour of comedy actually requires about a week of production work and actually trying things out and things like that. So it was really being paid 10 grand for about a week of work. But I did that gig. I got paid the 10 grand for a half hour of comedy. So I'm now a professional comedian who's gotten paid to stand up and tell jokes. So maybe I would do more of that if I wasn't doing everything else I was doing. Maybe I would do more of that. Hard to tell.
So Randall, what's your favorite database? Do you have any a favorite database engine?
My favorite, Postgres. That's easy. My least favorite, MySQL.
why don't you like MySQL or MariaDB?
Well, Maria's better. But it's still weird. It's still weird. And no disrespect for Monty. Monty's a cool guy. We've had him on the show. I've been in a number of conferences with him and all that stuff. But I just like Postgres from the ground up designed better. MySQL seems to have all these backward compatibilities with when it was really, really bad. And so there's a lot of problems that I think are solved now by being settings that aren't set out of the box. But, I mean... even Maria doesn't have, good online DDL changes, whereas, Postgres, you can add all sorts of things as transactionally. So you can add an entire table or entire columns and stuff and not bring down your database while it's going on. One of my other big clients right now, ZipRecruiter, we're having to make some online changes, and they use a tool called Percona Online Schema Change or whatever, but it's still rough to use. It's still really rough to use. I'd rather use Postgres any day. Postgres is a real database.
So another question from the chat room. What is the project that you've had on Floss Weekly so far this year that you've gotten the most excitement about?
Oh, this year. See, now you're going to make me actually go to one of my favorite places. Thank God I don't have to actually maintain this, but there is a Wikipedia page for Floss Weekly. And some of you out there are maintaining it for me so that I can go there and look and see what shows I've done. Because I don't remember anymore. Every once in a while, somebody will ask me, this is show 310. So, I've done so many shows now that I can't remember all the shows I've done. And so I will end up Googling. Somebody will say, how about, they took out the show list. They took out the list. No, those crazy Wikipedia people. Now I have to actually remember what's been on the show. Here, I know there's another place to go for this, and that is twitch.tv/floss, just like I say at the end of every show. Let me go back and look back through some of these briefly. Of course, I like doing the episode 300 because I got to bring good old Chris DeVona back. That was kind of cool. Let's see here. Keep going back. The update to MyFos was kind of cool. I like that they're doing more things with the microfinance software. Nginx, of course. Nginx, huge. Nginx, probably running more websites than Apache might even be these days. So I'm really happy. At least it's sort of the layer in front of a lot of websites and stuff. So I'm just looking at the list. And not to belittle any of the other shows. I mean, we had some really amazing people on. We did a show about this little scale thing. I've heard of that. That might be cool. But Omegaverse, Universal Simulator stuff, that's kind of cool. Yeah, so, you know, I like them all. That's part of the thing. You know, I'm pretty happy with the few that with the ones we've had on that have been about actually doing. CrisisNet, yeah, CrisisNet was great too. So that was actual access to doing things using open source software to actually make a difference in the world. So I kind of like those kinds of shows. Not to say the rest of the shows aren't important. You know, getting your work done, making yourself employable by being able to make a difference for people on a practical basis. Rather than just a humanitarian basis. So that's kind of cool. So, yeah. Anyway, there we go.
So a follow-up question to that was, are there any projects that you've started using after having them on the show?
Ooh, well, I always say that I will. There's been many, many shows where I said, I've got to download this and start playing with. Probably the biggest one, the one that's going to make the biggest difference in my upcoming offerings as a professional, is Dart. So once we had Dart on the show, I have just been playing with Dart. I've been using Dart. I have a couple of clients that are looking at using Dart for their software, including insightcruises.com. Eventually their booking engine and their some of their back-end stuff will be done in Dart. I think that's probably the biggest one that's had an impact on me is using Dart. You know, I've said I was going to use Jitsi for everything, and I don't even fire Jitsi up anymore. We haven't had Emacs on the show, but I use Emacs every day. Yeah, I think Dart's probably going to be the answer to that one.
So you mentioned Insight Cruises. Anybody who's seen you in the show or maybe has talked to you before knows that mm-hmm. you go on cruises all the time, right? That's like your thing. Mm-hmm. What do you like about these cruises? Are they geek cruises, you know, with other techie people, or are you going, you know, with old people and other couples?
Yeah, I just grab six random old people and I say, we're going on a cruise together. I think it'd be yes. scary. No, no. InsightCruises.com has been a client of mine now for 14 years. I was the first speaker on the first cruise, which was about Pearl. We had me and Larry Wall and Tom Christensen and a bunch of other people, about 10 instructors all told, and about 200 attendees total. Now, that's back when it was called Geek Cruises, when it was more about just technology-related things. The ones today are more broad-based, like Scientific American Magazine or Macworld Magazine or Quilting Magazine, Sky and Telescope, things like that. They're the marketing partners for that. But this is like, it's been about 75 sailings now. So it's been a while, maybe 80 now, I think, somewhere in there. And I've been on most of them. I didn't think I would like cruising at all. Because again, like you said, I thought it was just going to be a bunch of old people and shuffleboard was basically my entire experience of that. So that was pretty much my entire experience. But when Neil Bauman, my now longtime friend, back then, and attended one of my classes and invited me to come help put together a program, because he wanted to combine his two favorite things, which was teaching and being on cruise ships. He'd been on a number of cruise ships before that, so he also wanted to have that be part of his business. And so he brought me on, and again, I didn't think I'd like cruising, but at the end of that first cruise, it was a 7-day cruise out of Vancouver, British Columbia, up to Juneau and back. After the end of the first cruise, I said, okay, I want to do another one. Can I do another one? And he said, well, okay, I'll put you on the second one as well. And the second one was on Java, Java Jam. We were over in the Caribbean, and I taught about regular expressions, so because Pearl's regular expressions and Java's regular expressions are pretty much the same. But I didn't know anything else about Java, so it was great. So I got to attend the rest of the classes. Third one didn't fit me so well. So I says, well, I can't give you a free ride, which essentially what a speaker gets. They get their room paid for, and often, depending on their stature, perhaps their spouse paid for, and perhaps you know, free airfare and things like that. He says, I can't give you a free ride because you're just carrying my notebook around or whatever, right? I said, sure, but I do run a training company, so I do know how to set these up. He says, well, I'll give it to you at wholesale. So on half the cruises, when I've actually been a speaker, I get a free ride. And on the half that I'm just helping Neil out with the all the behind-the-scenes stuff or just attending the classes, I get it at wholesale, which is about half price. So it's a great run either way. I end up on about six cruises a year. And now Neil has started doing land cruises, sort of an odd name. But I was in Turkey for 12 days. Going to all sorts of digs and archaeology sites and museums and stuff. About midway through that particular tour, somebody asked, what day is this? And I said, I don't know, take the number of sites we've seen and divide by three. I think it'll tell you what day it is. Because there's just so much stuff that we saw. It was just an amazing thing. And coming up in January, we're going to Cuba. So I'll be in Cuba for 6 days, 7 days, something like that, on an official tour. So I get to have my passport stamped and everything, flying out of Miami on a chartered flight. And so that'll be amazing, too. So this is the kind of stuff I get to go do. I've been in 50 countries, thanks to my friend Neil, and I've been on 60 or 70 cruises all over the world. And I just really enjoy that I get an opportunity to see the world as part of my job. And he gets the opportunity to have me teach and help him out. And I also do all the behind-the-scenes work for his websites and keep those up and running. So that's the really long answer for that. And, yes, there are old people on there. We don't take over the whole cruise. But I've never played shuffleboard on a cruise ship yet. Never once.
You're missing out, man.
I know. I've walked by it. But I've never actually had the patience to go play shuffleboard.
Well, Guillermo was talking when he mentioned you mentioned the six random old people going on the cruise. I was thinking to myself that would make a hilarious reality TV show.
That would. I'll have to suggest that to Neil. Random old cruise.
So one of the things that you've posted a lot on Google Plus is a lot of the stuff you've been doing recently related to your health. And so one of the questions that someone submitted is what you've learned over the past year, 2 years or so, that you've been making all these like radical changes and kind of what you've discovered through that process.
Well, there's probably about four or five primary things because they sort of completely impacted the way I choose to eat now. I originally changed the way I eat because I knew I was both overweight and that was affecting me in terms of giving me sleep apnea, which was affecting my blood pressure. So my weight was affecting my blood pressure as well. I was like 170 over 110 when I went in to see a doctor for unrelated reasons. And that was my wake-up call. At age 50, I shouldn't have blood pressure that's like that. And he wanted to immediately put me on drugs. And I said, I know I'm overweight. Let me fix that first. And my friend Andy, who had been a buddy of mine at the bar I was frequenting in Culver City, had been talking to me about this thing that he called bulletproof coffee and also about low carb and things like that. So I had ignored him most of the time. But, of course, once you have a wake-up call, you start paying attention to everything around you. You know, what is the universe actually trying to tell me about this stuff? And so I started to watch the movie Fathead, which was his introduction to it as well, and started Googling for the things that he was talking to me about. And the primary things I've learned so far is that the standard American diet has way too much carbs in it, way too much. Like, you know, people really shouldn't be unless you're burning it off instantly, like you're doing some sort of high performance thing, like you're going to go jog 20 miles or whatever, not jog, but run 20 miles, run a marathon or something. You don't need the typical 200 to 300 grams of carbs that we all eat every day. It's just crazy. My typical intake is around 30 to 50 grams a day of carbs. And what I replace that with is fat. So one of the other most important things I learned is saturated fat is not bad for you. That was all covariate studies, and now they've done actual randomized clinical trials. Saturated fat is not bad. What is bad for you, and this is, of course, what big industry doesn't want you to know, are soy, canola, and corn oil. Those things, the process that they make those by, basically turn all the oils into hardened oils, and they go into your arteries and veins, and your body builds with these hardened oils, and that's what makes your arteries and veins stiff and actually causes heart disease, cardiovascular disease, arterial disease. I still have to eat some of that stuff because I am in restaurants all the time and they haven't learned yet you should be cooking in coconut oil and olive oil and things like that. So I take, where's my primrose here? I take some evening primrose, which is really good omega-6 stuff. So I take that every day as one of my supplements. And that tries to replace some of the omega-6 that I eat that restaurants do bad with good stuff. I also put coconut oil in my tea every morning. So I have a little bit of coconut oil in there. And that also helps with more omega-3s to try to balance that out. So basically, the biggest shifts I've made are radically reducing carbs, increasing the amount of good oils I eat, also reducing the amount of fiber, but I don't want to make this a show entirely about health. But there's a few other things changes I made. But that's the big one. Get rid of the carbs. Get off that stupid standard American diet with the carb cycle. I also have almost all grains cut out of my diet. I found that I'm actually allergic not just to gluten, but to wheat entirely. The modern wheat does bad things to my joints. And I only know that because I cut carbs out. And one of the things cutting carbs out is you cut wheat out. And all of a sudden, my joints had less pain. And every time since then, I've done experiments. Once in a while, I'll add wheat back in just to see, or add a gluten-free wheat even. And both times, under both circumstances, my joints start hurting again. So it's clearly related. So I'm almost entirely wheat cut out and much more enjoying that way. I've been interviewed a couple times about my dietary change, but unfortunately it was for a podcast that completely pod faded in the sense that they stopped doing it and the website's gone. So I hope again to be interviewed for a much more detailed view of my views about modern nutrition, what the USDA is influenced by, what the FDA is influenced by. Again, I'm not a professional about this stuff, so take this with a grain of salt. And by the way, salt's okay for you too. Thanks for the grain of salt. But I'm also not a professional programmer. I didn't study to be a programmer, and yet that's what I do every day for my living. So I am good at studying things. I'm good at synthesizing information from looking at, coalescing information from all sorts of great different studies and stuff. So in the same way that I am a programmer, a modern programmer that can practice this as my trade, I believe I have studied sufficient amount of information about nutrition and about proper health that I can properly advise on this as well. But I am not a professional on those, and there are people that get mad at me for giving advice on that. That's just too bad. I'll still advise anyway.
So there's another question. You already mentioned you were giving, you were teaching somewhere, right? What kind of classes are you teaching? Are they programmer related, or are they, some other crazy open source thing that you're doing?
Well, I've given talks on lots of different things, typical 1-hour talks. When I used to spend a lot of time going around the country teaching Perl classes all day, which was my primary income in the late 90s, was teaching Learning Perl and Intermediate Perl, essentially the classes that go with those books. But in the evenings, I would be at, user groups and stuff all over the country, all over the U.S. at that point, not outside the country because of other restrictions, but that's a long story. So all through that time period, I would have like 1-hour talks on, why I like ZFS or what's FreeBSD about, or, using GNU Emacs effectively, things like that. So I would have those small talks as well. But primarily I was teaching Perl through the late 90s as my primary income. And I now still have a training company, but very few requests for classes these days. It's really hard to find 15 to 20 people who want to learn Perl that are all starting in the same place and all want to end up roughly in the same place. Like they have no Perl and they want to get back effective 100-line programs, which is what Learning Perl is. Or they're starting at 100-line programs and they all want to get 10,000-line programs, which is what Intermediate Perl is. Working for a given company. We tried doing open enrollment versions of those, and those didn't sell. Not recently, anyway. We used to sell those all the time, though, back in the dot-com boom. So it's just it's a little bit tougher. I will like to say, though, the timing's amazing. Tom Phoenix, who is my senior instructor for Stonehenge, is this very week, actually out teaching a Perl class. It's our first Perl class this year, which shows you how often they come along these days. So I assigned that to him. So he's happily teaching a class for me this week. And although I kind of miss teaching, I started doing a little bit every day when I'm doing things like Floss Weekly and also in my day job. So it's kind of cool. That's what I used to teach primarily. And it's still what I teach given the opportunity.
Based on your experience, this is another question from the chat room. Based on your experience at the companies you work with, what are the best opportunities for doing open source consulting today? And how does one get started doing something like that?
Wow. Well, I got started long before I had to ask that question. So I got started because I just wanted to be in the industry. I just thought that maybe someday I'd get a job at a bank or a government thingy, and it turned out that open source – well, we didn't call it open source. We called it shareware and stuff back then. What would somebody do today? I think the big thing – as evidenced by a lot of the shows that we've had here on Floss Week over the last couple of years, the big thing is the cloud. The big thing is scalable applications using non-traditional databases, using modern infrastructures like Perl would be the catalyst of the generation, things like that. I think that's, you know, learning about data scaling, learning about cloud management, learning about, you know, what are these proprietary services doing? Like, how does Amazon Web Services actually work? Or, you know, if you're going to use one of the open solutions, like, you know, how do things like, my brain's going this morning. Not enough tea yet today. But the things that we scale on, the things that scale well and are open source for doing infrastructure. In fact, actually, we got one coming up. We've got CoreOS, which is Linux for massively server deployment. So that sort of thing. Learn about that stuff. And there, you can build those up in VMs like Docker that we're going to have in a couple of weeks. You can build up Docker VMs that talk to each other. So you can kind of play with this all on your own. Give it to, it's all open source software. Learn about that stuff, and you'll be a lot more valuable to the future employers that are out there, because I know that a lot of my clients are all struggling with the same sort of things. How do we scale our app? How do we make it run in the cloud? How do we manage that? How do we also manage the local development of it before we deploy to the cloud? Things like Docker are useful to solve that sort of thing. So learn about that. I think that's going to be the best way to go with that. So, yeah.
So you and I kind of got into the open source area. Well, and in fact, into the whole programming area, you know, in the same way. I also didn't have a formal education until recently. Mm-hmm. What would you tell somebody who's trying to get into this area now, if they want to, you know, start off programming? What would be your five Randall tips of the day?
You know, it's the same reason I don't teach the beginnings of programming. It's been so long since I've been there that I can't remember what I did to get over those humps. This is why learning Perl actually starts with, you already know what an array is, you know what a subroutine is. Because I don't remember what it took for me to learn why you would use an array. And so I can't teach that either. I can't teach anything that I can't recollect having learned recently. Same way, I don't know what I would tell somebody to get started. I know that sitting on the hiring side a lot, because I work with a lot of clients that I'm sometimes involved in the interview processes with them to bring on other people. I think a lot of them are looking for a formal education of some kind. And I think that's unfortunate, because I know that a lot of people are sometimes just just naturally good at stuff like this. And I'd rather hire somebody that's naturally good rather than anything else. But also people who play with this stuff in their off hours. You know, if your only exposure to that sort of stuff is classroom time, and you don't do this stuff nights and weekends, I don't know that I want to hire you. I don't know that I want you on my company, because I want people for whom this is interesting, for whom this is what they're thinking about when they're in the shower, when they're driving to work every day. Oh, I got an idea for an algorithm. You know, I want to see people like that working next to me because it's a lot more fun that way. And I think that's probably what employers are looking for as well. So if you're not naturally drawn to programming, like I was back, you know, 30 years ago, if you're not naturally drawn to programming, please don't be a programmer. There's plenty of us out here. We don't need more people who are doing this because it's a good living. It actually is a good living. I want people who would do this even if they weren't paid. And I'm that kind of person, because I program for myself on nights and weekends without getting paid. I'm getting paid in the reward of having done something fun.
So we're just about out of time, but we wanted to make sure that if there's anything that we didn't ask you that you wanted to ensure was covered.
Huh, I've heard that question before. I wonder who invented that question.
It's a good one. It's a good
one. Yeah, it is a good question. I like it. But, you know, it always puts the – I now know what it's like, because I do that sometimes at the end of the show, and it really puts the guest on the spot. because they go, well, what didn't we talk about? Let me think. How do you think about what you didn't get talk about? You know, because I didn't have a list of questions actually I wanted to have for this show. So what didn't I get asked? Well, you haven't asked the two questions yet, but that's probably the next two questions you're going to ask me. but let's see here. No, I think we covered a good variety of stuff. And I have to say, I think this went better than I thought it was going to, which is good. But I love hearing myself talk, so maybe that's why. No, you guys did great. And a special thanks also to the people in the chat rooms and the people who emailed you ahead of time for a good variety of questions. I really appreciated sort of the breadth and depth of things that you and especially the few that made me think for a bit. That was nice. So it's cool. So, I think that's sort of cool there. So that's the answer to that. Next question, or maybe that was it.
No, we have the standard two questions that always get asked of every guest. We're going to change it up a little bit because it's you. Mm-hmm. So what is your favorite compiled programming language?
Perl.
Because
Perl has a compiler. It compiles down to internal bytecodes before it runs the code. It's not a strict interpreter. It's actually a compiled language. Yes.
Got us with the legal mumbo jumbo.
No. Darn you.
So the final question, what is the worst text editor that you've ever used?
I sometimes swear at Emacs. Does that help? So Emacs, it's my, I love it and I hate it. Same thing with Perl. Sometimes I really hate Perl too. So, but worst text editor, I think a lot of people were trying to get me to use, there's these proprietary OS X desktop editors like BBEdit, and there's some others that are out there, and people swear by them. Well, it always made me mad when I tried to use those editors, so I went right back to using Emacs again. So, probably any proprietary desktop OS X editor, or almost any editor that we'll just stop with that.
I
hate IDEs in general. So I hate Xcode. I hate Eclipse. I just sort of hate IDEs because they seem to be not my hands. My hands want Emacs codes, and Emacs codes want my hands. So probably Eclipse would definitely fall in that category.
It's a good answer.
Okay.
All right. Well, I think we're done with that portion.
Well, guys, thanks a lot for asking me all these questions. And let me go ahead and wrap up the show unless you have anything further you want to discuss.
No. I think we're good, Guillermo.
No, I'm fine.
That was a lot of fun.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, given that we're almost out of time, let's go ahead and thank you guys. And thank you, the audience, also for all the questions. That's been a lot of fun. I have been busy working on filling up the rest of the schedule so we don't have to do another show immediately like this. Although this actually didn't work out so bad. So, yay. So, just added to the schedule, we have the D language. D is in dog. D is in Delta language, which is a C-like language, sort of the successor to C, open source language. They just got added to the schedule for next week. Unfortunately, we had to move the Docker show down a couple weeks. But we have it back on the schedule. Docker, of course, that famous container manager that I mentioned actually a couple times in a couple of my answers. That's coming up in a couple weeks. Also added to the schedule, sorry for the cough there, is Phoenix EDU, which is modular software platform for academic and administrative management for higher order institutions. So that just got added to the schedule. It's going to be fun talking to these guys. CoreOS, which is Linux for massive massive server deployments. Excuse me there. RethinkDB, also just added to the schedule, is a distributed database for JSON docs. Yet another one of those, but it has some features, I guess, that make it pretty interesting. OpenSMTPD, which is OpenBSD's contribution to the mail server space. That'll be a little fun. Be fun, too. We still have a few schedule slots open, so I'm still sending out emails trying to fill up the rest of the schedule. So if you want to see how I'm doing on that, you can go to the big spreadsheet, which is linked to from our homepage, twit.tv/floss. Has the link to the spreadsheet that has all the upcoming guests and stuff. You can follow us on Floss Weekly on Google+, which also mirrors over to Floss Weekly on Twitter. We do have a live chat, which we took a number of questions from this time, which is at live.twit.tv. We tape at 8:30 a.m. Pacific time on Wednesdays, every time that we tape on our regular schedule. But you can go to the spreadsheet and show you the exact schedule. You can follow me at Google Plus at Randall L. Schwartz, find out where I'm going to be and where I've been. I'm also, that's mirrored over to Merlyn, M-E-R-L-Y-N, on Twitter, so you can see me there as well. Speaking of where I will be, I am going to join the celebration coming up this New Year's Eve at the Brick House. So I guess 24 hours of Twit Live. I will be there along with Aaron Newcomb, who's going to be there for some of the shows. I believe we're not actually doing a Floss Weekly that day. I think we're just going to be doing lots and lots of live shows. That'll be fun. So that's pretty much everything on my list. Any plugs you guys want to do?
I guess not.
You know what? I was going to do my usual plug. The Scale Call for Papers is open. Closes December 15th. The show will be February 19th through the 23rd, 2015. So if anyone's interested in speaking, now would be the good time to submit talks.
Hmm. What if that applies to me? I guess I better hurry up and do that, huh?
Of course it does.
I could have a talk. And Guillermo, anything?
Yeah, well, as for me, if anybody's interested in, you know, open source, open hardware projects, just check me out on Twitter and on YouTube, I guess. That's pretty much it.
Very cool, very cool. Well, guys, once again, thanks for helping coordinate this particular show. And I guess that's about all I have to say as well. So we'll see you all again next week on Floss Weekly.